Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our October board meeting. We have another exciting day. The bar is set very high. If you followed yesterday's session, 12-0 straight through all papers, right? So, guys, get it to go. We start with goodwill and impairment.
Thank you, Andreas. So before getting into the two meaty papers, I just wanted to highlight a bit of the discussion in agenda paper 18 around our plan for redeliberating the board's preliminary views on disclosures. So as noted in paragraph 3 of that paper, we plan to follow what we call a building blocks approach, and this means that we're planning on asking the board for a series of tentative decisions that will eventually build into a package of proposed disclosure requirements. Of course, there might be some interactions between decisions made at different meetings, and where that's the case, we'll highlight those in agenda papers. And if the board were to make a tentative decision that maybe requires the reassessment of a previous tentative decision, then we would bring that back to the board for reconsideration. So in this meeting, we start the building blocks process by asking the board for a tentative decision on whether applying the conceptual framework, the board can require entities to disclose the information required by its preliminary views in financial statements. So that's the topic of agenda paper 18A. So much of our analysis in paper 18A repeats the analysis we provided to the board in July. In our view, based on the conceptual framework, this information can be required in financial statements. This is because we think that the information meets the objectives of the financial statements as described in the conceptual framework in IAS 1, and also have some analysis of the considerations of forward-looking information in the conceptual framework in this paper. The question for the board is listed on page 12, but before asking that question, I did want to highlight that if the board agrees with the staff recommendation in this meeting, the board could still decide at a future meeting not to require entities to disclose some or all of this information in financial statements for other reasons. So, for example, some of the practical considerations that we talk about in agenda paper 18B. So we'd first like to ask the board members whether you agree with our recommendation that, based on the conceptual framework, information about the benefits an entity's management expects from a business combination and the extent to which management's objectives are being met. So, for example, information such as the subsequent performance of business combinations or quantitative information about expected synergies can be required in financial statements.
Thanks, Greg. Floor's open. Nick, you have the first go.
Thanks, Andreas. And thanks to staff for a really good set of papers, really helpful in pulling threads of the arguments here together, I felt. So I agree with where you land that, based on the conceptual framework, the information that we're talking about here can be included in financial statements. And I think the paper very helpfully seeks to differentiate between what the conceptual framework says and perhaps some perceptions of what the conceptual framework says. So I welcome that. There are three points that I just want to highlight in particular. First of all, what we hear from users is that the stewardship aspect of the objectives of financial reporting as set out in the conceptual framework is important to them. And I think that particularly ties back into the strategic rationale for an acquisition. That's a key piece of information in terms of thinking about delivery there. The second point, which I always think of is Tom's view, is that when the expectation about what an acquisition would deliver, as expressed at the time of the acquisition, is historic inherently. That's when it was expressed. It may change in the future, but that is something that is factual and historic and is not a forecast. The third thing, it's important, but perhaps not quite so important as the other two, is where we discuss non-financial metrics. I prefer to think of it about it in terms of qualitative information. I think it's still financial in nature in terms of what it speaks to. May not always have numbers involved, but I think we just need to be careful around that and not kind of split the world into financial and non-financial. I think the implications there certainly, again, by definition, do have financial consequences. Thank you.
So just to clarify your last point, Nick, would that, for instance, mean through a business combination, I get market access, and that is my prime driver, it's obviously something that's non-financial, but it has financial implications. That's what you meant, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Sue, please.
Thank you for this paper. I think it was really useful and very thoughtful paper. So, and I think it's a helpful addition to the materials for this, the decision-making for the board, not in isolation, which you're correctly pointing out, but as one cornerstone so that we can try and get people into a common space for the discussions. And I think it's a very helpful analysis to focus in on what the conceptual framework actually does and doesn't say about information, and to provide this link to the amounts that are recognised as a result of a business combination. I also thought that the observation about stewardship was actually a really important one, given the information we've heard from investors on this. So certainly not a basis for, you know, being gung-ho in isolation, but I think a helpful document to set the scene for the discussions. Just in relation to the last point that Nick raised on financial and non-financial, I'd completely agree with what he said. I also think we need to be really careful around the use of those terms, financial and non-financial, because there's really not at all a common understanding about what those terms mean, and it matters a lot in some places in our literature. Some people think EBITDA is non-financial because it's got, you know, depreciation and things like that. So I think I'd also caution on that, but I help people and I agree with the analysis. Thank you.
Ginger.
Thank you. First of all, I also think it's a very thoughtful, very well written paper, and particularly address those concerns raised by stakeholders where we come from, particularly starting from conceptual framework. I think the two areas you addressed is right. First is whether those information are really related to the entity's assets and liability, and the second is whether those information are really useful to the users. So I would like to start from the whether those information are useful to the users. I think I agree with Nick and Sue said that. First, I also think those information actually would help to those investors to assess future cash flow. For example, expected synergy or something like that. And also to help for the users to assess the stewardship, because I remember when the board developed our proposal in a discussion paper, one of our objectives is try to provide some information would hold you know, management accountable for those business, you know, combination they have conducted. So from usefulness of those information perspective, I think it's consistent with the conceptual framework. Secondly, whether those information, for example, strategic rationale, objective, particularly expected synergies, related to the entity's assets and liability. I think those factors actually affected and determined the price the company paid for the acquired business. And then those prices actually allocated to those assets and liabilities recognized in the acquirer's, you know, consolidated financial statement. So I think it's naturally those strategic objective, rational, particularly expected synergies directly, naturally related to the asset liability recognized on the entity's, you know, financial statement. Particularly, we always say, what's the nature of the goodwill? One of the theory underlying the goodwill is that those goodwill reflected expected synergies. So I think from both sides, I think requiring company to disclose those information actually consistent with the conceptual framework. And also whether those information are forward-looking information or not. I also don't think they are forward-looking information, because as I said, that the price paid for acquiring that business are historical costs, historical information. So those factors affected and determined the price should be actually historical information. Otherwise, they will be contradicted each other. So I think those information, although including future factors, because they have to think about expected synergy future factors. But those judgments, those estimates, they are made based on the conditions, situation, exactly at the acquisition date. So I think they are historical information rather than forward-looking information. So with that, I agree with staff's proposal, staff's recommendation to include those information in the disclosure package of the business combination.
I will probably express a more nuanced view on that, yeah, on the paper. So I agree with the outcome. That the information, uninformation may be provided in the notes to the financial statements rather than to somewhere else. But I'm a bit concerned on the information to be provided. And so the paper focuses on forward-looking information. I'm not sure that it's the major concern. The major concern for preparers and companies are commercial sensitivity of the information, and notably on the information about the subsequent performance of business combinations, and quantitative information about expected synergies, which is within the question you're asking us. So if I have no problem in answering yes, earned information should be in the financial statements, I have a lot of concern in saying that the information should be about the subsequent performance of business combinations and quantitative information about expected synergy at this stage, because commercial sensitivity and the analysis on commercial sensitivity has not yet been really analyzed. Hence, I think the most important paragraph of the paper is paragraph 4. If the board agrees with our conclusion, so I don't disagree, that's what I've expressed, the board could still decide at a future meeting not to require entities to disclose some or all of this information in financial statements for other reasons, such as practical considerations. I think it's the most important paragraph of the paper. And I'm pretty much... if I sum it up, I could say I agree with not forcing companies to provide information about the subsequent performance of business combination and quantitative information about expected synergies in the notes, rather than not forcing those companies to provide the information elsewhere.
Can I? The question you asked is a more narrow one. You're right that there's other considerations, so you're not being asked whether you agree that this information should be provided in the financial statements. But when you're asked whether or not you agree with the question, the question is a narrow one in the sense it's just saying, based on the framework, do you agree that in theory, setting aside all those other things which are real, that it can be required from a conceptual perspective? And then at another time, you'll be asked for other considerations, including the ones that you rightly pointed out.
As I said, I agree that conceptually, earned information
but
may
we shouldn't
be
get
required
carried away if you
in
agree.
The financial statements. but I'm worried on which information. It's always the same.
So if you put your hand up, I shouldn't get too excited. Is that your basic message?
He agrees, he says.
Bruce.
Thanks very much. I guess the major challenge I've got with this, of course, is that what we're really trying to define here is whether or not this is forward-looking information. And I think the paper, when I read the paper, I find that there's kind of arguments both for and against it as we're going through it. Some parts we're saying, yes, this is forward-looking information. Otherwise, we're saying it's not. And I think the challenge with that, to me, comes into the fact that I think we've got a real problem with the way that 3.6 in the conceptual framework is written. If we take a look at how 3.6 is written, and it's not the first time we've had a similar debate on how different people are interpreting this, but, I mean, the first two, when you look at A and B kind of set out what I consider to be incredibly broad criteria in terms of what you would include. I mean, we're talking here relates to an entity's assets or liabilities, even if they're unrecognized, equity or you know, income and expenses. Well, not much left. So kind of if you're saying it relates to something and we're saying that it's useful to users, well, it can be in there. So I think they're incredibly broad. The challenge to me is that the only way we constrain that is in the next part of the paragraph. And when you start looking through the next paragraph, it gives an example of that, but then it also says financial statements that do not typically provide other types of forward-look information, for example, explanatory material about management's expectation and strategies. So that's the only constraint in 3.6 around incredibly broad principles. Now, do I think necessarily 3.6 could be reworded? Yes, I do. I think that we could have made it a bit more clearer, but given this is what we've got at the moment, it's the only constraint I can see. And the worry I've got is when we start looking at what these are, I struggle to get out of the concept that these are effectively management's expectations and strategies. I really, in my mind, I don't see how some of these disclosures get out of that bucket. And when the starting premise in 3.6 says that these aren't necessarily forward look, these aren't the things that you'd report on, I now need the evidence to say to me, well, hang on, we're not saying that that constraint applies, we're saying that there's something else. And I'm still questioning whether or not, in my mind, I think we've crossed that barrier yet. Do I think that the information is useful? Yes, I do. I mean, I'm the first person to agree. I think there is a degree of what we can put for management, and I think there's a degree of what management can kind of get out there and say. But my worry is that this is, it's difficult to look at this in isolation. And I come back to the comment Bertrand's made, and I think we've said this before, but commercial sensitivity does concern me. And I don't think it's something we can say, oh, it's a different factor, it's out of set. This, to me, could very heavily impact on the value that's created in a business. And we talk about stewardship. One of management's stewardships is to make sure they're maintaining shareholder value. And if they go out there and give information that's highly market sensitive or commercially sensitive, they can end up destroying value in an acquisition. So I think that it's very difficult to turn around and say, no, we need to give this because it's displaying management stewardship of assets or the stewardship of the business, when in essence this can actually end up creating it. So I do think it becomes very difficult to kind of look at those two things. Where we talk in paragraph 24 about the fact that we're saying, well, there's initial assumptions and we're commenting those in the future, it's not forward-looking. I agree with you. In the years, the subsequent years, when you're commenting on the achievement of those, yes, that's not the issue. But when you're setting those initial assumptions, those are the ones I'm more concerned about. So it's not the subsequent look back. It's the upfront where I'm putting that stuff in. And that just concerns me in terms of where we are. Kind of coming back to how I would answer the question, I mean, I'm still... I was a little bit kind of concerned about how we drafted the question, and maybe this came back to some of the comments Sue was saying and Bertrand was commenting on earlier in terms of how we've commented on the question, because we're saying, based on the conceptual framework, do we think that this type of information about subsequent performance and that can be provided in the financial statements? Well, if you're asking me if I can vote on whether anything can be provided, I would say I think you can put anything in, because there's nothing in the conceptual framework that says to me you can't put it in. So my worry is that what we're voting on is going to be anybody who doesn't agree with the question, I would seriously challenge, because I think the way the question's posed says there's nothing in the conceptual framework prohibiting it. Whereas I think if you put it the other way, saying, do you think the conceptual framework supports putting it in, I think we could potentially get a different answer. So I'm a little bit concerned about the way we've kind of worded the question. Because I do think that when you look at the one versus the other, I think that people around the table could get to a different answer depending on which way we worded that. So, yeah, coming to the question, I wouldn't necessarily... I'd have to vote yes on the answer, because I think conceptual frameworks is anything that could be useful can be in the financials. And by the way, I do agree with this being in the financials, not in the management commentary or the notes. So that I do agree with. So the answer to that's going to be yes. I don't think you can vote no to that. But the question would be, on the specific disclosures we are referencing there, those are the ones I think we need to focus in on.
Thanks, Bruce. Lika.
I admit that some information like the metrics, objective, rationale, and synergy might more closely relate to other information included in the MC, management commentary. But still, as long as the information can meet the objective of financial statement of IS1 and then consistent with the frameworks, rationale, I think the standard can require the entity to disclose the information about the objective, rationale, and synergies, especially because I truly think the characteristic of goodwill quite unique and then different from those of tangible assets other asset. So I think it's quite important to understand the management objective and rationale for business combination, specific business combinations, as well as the synergy information, especially the, because of without that rationale, I don't think that goodwill has a value for creating the future cash flow in the future. So I think it's really valuable and it's validated and it's really important and crucial information for the user to understand what type of the strategies are underlining the goodwill and how the goodwill can generate the future cash flow. And then also, I really think synergy information is a source and then also drivers of the entity generate the value and or the generate the future cash flow. So that information is more important for the users when they consider the existence or measurement of the goodwill. And also, I think when accounting, if I consider the accounting for goodwill, especially the value is considered based on the estimate of the future cash flow, that means it's very crucial for the user to understand how the management estimate of the future cash flow. And also, I really think the strategies and rationale of the business combination themselves are underlining such explanation. So I truly think that such information has a direct link with the goodwill itself, and also the any impairment losses or even the amortization had a direct link between the such explanation. So that's the reason I support the staff recommendation.
Thank you, Erika.
This is a really tough one. Maybe I'll start with an easy thing. I really liked a lot of the stuff in the second paper. And it's not that I dislike this stuff, but this stuff actually has, to me, some inherent problems that I think we should ultimately sort out. But I wanted to, you know, so in the second chapter, I'll be much, I think there's some neat possible solutions that may make some of this moot. But I think one of the things, and it was interesting, Nick alluded to that I'd been supportive of kind of an argument that Jin Chao made is, one question is it not forward-looking? In which case, this question of what paragraph 3.6 says is not really relevant. If it's not forward-looking and not forward-looking is fine, then we don't have any problem in interpreting 3.6, which talks about forward-looking information. But how do we go forward? And I think it's important that we go forward with a kind of consistent conceptual basis instead of arguments. And I think one of the things that we did in the discussion paper is in paragraphs 229 to 232, we raised the issue of forward-looking, and then we made the argument that it wasn't forward-looking what we were doing. And then we had a whole pile of people write in and take exception to this. And they said, but what made it difficult was we basically, in doing this, implicitly cast doubts on the legitimacy of forward-looking by saying, you know, now we sort of related it to securities regulators and stuff. And then we said, but then we skate away by saying it's not forward-looking, so we're going to not address it directly. Now in this paper, we're suddenly coming back to address it directly. So having implicitly, you know, let the legitimacy of this to the side, we now have to address it directly. And this is where I think it's really important that we be consistent going forward. So it seems to me that if going forward we can do at least four things. Just make the argument it's not forward-looking and avoid this forward-looking issue, which is a nice, tidy thing. And I think you can make a lot of good arguments, and I've tried to make them in the past. you could say all forward-looking is okay, and now argue on a conceptual basis. There's a whole series of things you can just flow through because all forward-looking is okay. You could then say another alternative is that some forward-looking is okay, and that's where paragraph 3.6 comes in. Or you could say that no forward-looking is okay. So we have to settle on you can have no forward-looking is good and some forward-looking is okay. We need to settle and decide exactly what we're going to go for. I say that because I agree with what Bruce said, is 3.6 wording is not entirely clear. The first bit, which appears in paragraph 30, and the whole thing appears in paragraph 20, to me provides necessary conditions. So if you satisfy these, you can get in, but you might still be out. And to the degree that there's any circumscribing goes on, that happens in the latter part, which appears in paragraph 20. You can see it. And so what a lot of it rests on, and if I were to pull the exact sentence, it says, the sentence is, financial statements do not typically provide other types of forward-looking information, which Bruce quoted earlier. So the question is, how do you interpret other types? And if I think about, I'll do a kind of a silly example. If I simply state that Tom does not like other fruit, you really can't interpret that. Other needs to be set off against something. So if I say Tom likes apples, pears, and grapes, Tom does not like other fruit, you can interpret the other. So when I read it in this thing, I ask myself, what is the other? And there's at least three possibilities. And I think this goes to kind of Bruce's concern about how clear the paragraph is. One is, it's other relative to A. Well, let's assume useful to investors is a taken for given. But it would be other than stuff related to assets and liabilities that exist at the end of the period. That's one possibility of other. The other is that it could be relating to the sentence immediately before. It's other is other than measurement about assets and liabilities. And there's some reason to think that that holds. First of all, the immediacy, because that's normally how we set up other. But if I go through the standards and think about where do we allow forward-looking information? Okay, and typically it goes to measurement. IAS 36, impairment, we have all kinds of stuff on assumptions and measurement. IFRS 9, in expected credit loss, we have stuff on measurement. The assumptions related to measurement are legitimate. And even in fair value and some of the disclosures, those assumptions on level 3, I think, go to measurement. So typically where we've allowed forward-looking, it goes to measurement. And then we've got this thing that says typically other types don't get in. So to me, one of the things I've really struggled with, and as Bruce said, it relates to other things, is the paragraph is not certainly crystal clear. And I think if we are going to go forward, we should really decide exactly what grounds we want to battle on. It's nice if we can get to the not forward-looking, that's a really safe place. If it is forward-looking, we need to decide whether it's a circumscribed forward-looking or a wide-open forward-looking. And I actually think if I look at the way forward-looking is used in the standards and couple it with what is in 3.6, I don't think it can be uncircumscribed. I think it has to be limited in some way. So I'm really keen on going forward to this, but I think we should be really precise and we should all have a really good sense of what the conceptual basis of our arguments will be in defending this, because I do think these disclosures are very valuable and I want to see them preserved, but I don't want us to go out and then flounder because we've been equivocal about what our conceptual basis is. I think
thanks,
those
Tom.
Are all the things.
Thank you. Let's hear from Tadeu.
Thank you, Andreas. Thanks for the stuff. Quite useful paper analysis. And not only useful for this subject, but for other subjects that we are discussing as well, because I think that the demand from investors are changing and we are facing with some demand of information that is not traditionally, or it is beyond what we traditionally see in the financial statement. Therefore, I think that's a very important subject. And then I acknowledge, for example, what Tom said, and then he referred to many situations where actually the information might be maybe outside the traditional financial statement, but it still has some impact in the financial statement. And just looking at the Nick's article on climate change, how it impacts the financial statement. I mean, the world is changing, the demand is changing, and then we have to learn how to adapt to that one. I really believe that the moment other reports, or reports other than financial statements, become more regulated, consistent, and audited, it is likely that it will ease the pressure to bring some of this information to the financial statement. But in this meantime, I agree with the staff's recommendation. I think that I acknowledge what Bertrand said, but I agree with Sue. At this moment, we are deciding only that there is room for bringing some of this information to the financial statement. But I agree that subject to further assessment, especially from the practical concerns raised by the preparers. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Mary, Sue, and then I will draw to a close.
I'll start with saying I support the staff's analysis, and I don't agree with Bruce that it's worded in such a way that, you know, how could you object? Because the question is, can be required versus can be permitted, and I think the fact that it uses the word "can we require," you know, the "require" means we require, I think makes it a more rigorous question. But then stepping back, I want to comment about some of the challenges that Tom raised. I think it's a very good and useful paper. I give it the characterization, which I think the staff is what the staff intends, of necessary but not sufficient. So if I go back, as Tom said in the DP, we made the assertion that in our view, the information we were proposing to require was not forward-looking. And the reason is we're not asking people to give an up-to-date at the date the financial statements are, you know, published, quantification of expected future performance, but rather to tell us historically what expectations were factored into the pricing of the transaction. I stand by that, you know, that logic, but given the feedback we have of many people saying you are being inconsistent with your own conceptual framework, I think we had to do what the paper has done, which is go back to the conceptual framework and say, is the information that we contemplate, you know, that we contemplated and had a preliminary view we would require, inconsistent with our own conceptual framework? If we concluded it was, we still could require it, because this isn't, the conceptual framework is not a straitjacket that prohibits us from doing things, but then we'd have to explain why in this circumstance we overcame it. I agree with the staff analysis that says, you know, setting aside our view that it's not forward-looking information, if you believe it is forward-looking information, then does it run afoul of the language we have in the conceptual framework? I think it's a very good, solid analysis that demonstrates that it does not. Now, I think the third layer that I will add to this is the reality, and maybe instead of practical challenges, 18B should be called reality. Challenges of reality is our view is not the only one that matters when it comes to the question of is this forward-looking information. So all we're trying to do in this paper is say, for those who do not agree with us that the information we talked about requiring either for the, you know, about pricing of the initial transaction or the subsequent performance against initial expectations, including, as Rico was saying, the rationale for the transaction, is that inconsistent with the guidance that we have in our conceptual framework? And I think the staff has demonstrated that it is not, and therefore we could require it in the financial statements. I agree with Bruce that the conceptual framework does not prohibit a preparer from electing to include in financial statements information, but that's not the question you're asking us to weigh in on. So I support this, but I think, Tom's, be clear about your line of logic advice. Prompted me to think about articulating my line of logic is, in the first instance, I stand by the fact that it's not forward-looking, but given that others were not convinced, let's analyze their arguments, and I think this is what paper 18A does, and I support the staff analysis and recommendation.
Just a couple of observations following on from comments that others have made, and I think that that Tom summed it up well. I think it's really important that we have a clear conceptual basis for what we're talking about. And that's because we've got a difficult situation to deal with here. We've got investors who really like the idea of the information that we've proposed, and we've got preparers who, for many reasons, are not that excited about it. And we're trying to find a happy medium between those two things to do the right thing as standard setters. And that's always really, really difficult. But the best chance we've got of finding a path that we can navigate and defend, discuss, is if at least we are not talking at cross purposes. So the more we can say, you know, answer specific questions and so people don't say, conceptually it doesn't work. You start having a discussion about, I don't know, commercial sensitivity, and then somebody will start lobbing in on conceptual. It's like, you know, negotiating with your children, you know. they just throw whatever it is at you and they won't stick to one line of argument. And so I think as a board, we're just trying to say, okay, let's see if we can agree that on a conceptual basis, this is how we've analysed things. Then when we're having a discussion with somebody, we can say, okay, but that's what we thought there, so let's now have a proper discussion about commercial sensitivity, because that's the thing that's going to matter. Let's discuss that. Let's not get distracted by the conceptual discussion. Let's just know what we think there. And so I really support this paper to achieve that. And it's totally not enough. You get to 18B and it's like all bets are off again. But at least it's helpful, because then we've got one thing we know, okay, this is what the board as a whole hopefully thought, and let's have that as an anchor. I can't resist just saying one thing on 3.6, though, with that, you know, great general statement. And I think that Rika was very good with her choice of words when she was talking. She talked a lot, I don't know whether consciously or not, about a direct link. And that, for me, is what's really important, because for me, 3.6 isn't a free-for-all at all, because it starts off really clearly and it says, if you think it's forward-looking information, that it's included if it relates to entities' assets or liabilities, including unrecognised ones. You need a direct link between a particular asset and liability you're thinking about and this information. And for me, the for example is going on to try and explain what those A and Bs means. And that's why we have forward-looking inputs on impairment in IFRS 9, because it relates to a particular asset. We have it in 36. We're saying here it could make sense because it relates to goodwill and other carrying amounts, but it's that direct link that I think we're trying to hinge it on, because I don't think it is a free-for-all for forward-looking. That's why we have that paragraph, and it might, you know, it's not perfectly drafted, but I think it is trying to have that really strict anchor.
That's what I intended.
Bruce disagrees with that.
I know you want to close off. Can I just make one comment? I mean, the only thing I was going to say was I appreciate everybody saying we need to do this on the basis of the conceptual framework. My concern that I was expressing earlier is that the conceptual framework is more than 3.6. We talk about how users will assess management stewardship of how they've run the business all over paragraph for chapter 1. And what I'm saying is, to me, a key component of that is, would management be giving something that could damage the company? And I think that when you take the commercial sensitivity and say it has nothing to do with the conceptual framework, you're saying that we're saying that a very key aspect of management stewardship of how they're running this business in this circumstance should be ignored in determining whether or not... My concern is that I think the question should be rewritten as, do we think 3.6 agrees with this? But you can't say the conceptual framework, because there are other concepts in the conceptual framework, and I honestly believe that this is one of those that's going to impact it that we haven't got in. I'm glad I've got some debate. Sorry.
Okay, Zach, Nick, and then I close off.
So, I just, in response to that, I would start by saying I agree with the staff's position, and haven't said much because I think others said what I was going to say, probably much more eloquently. On that question that you bring up, Bruce, though, I think the difference is users tend to view the far more value important item as the price paid in the acquisition than subsequent disclosures about why they came up with the price. And we have reams of academic research demonstrating that acquisitions tend to destroy value rather than create them. So there is already a hurdle that you have to get over in documenting why this particular one makes sense. I think the construct that most users bring to goodwill is it's a reflection of what the market believed a company was worth before the acquisition, plus a premium paid. And the premium paid is entirely about the revenue and cost synergies. They may come from a lot of different places, but ultimately it's about the cash flows that you can derive after an acquisition that the company couldn't have done by itself. And that's why they view it as being directly related first to the purchase price paid, and then in a simplistic sense to the goodwill. There's also bargain purchase gains. I think that would also fall under 3.6 because it relates to a specific income item during the period. So I don't think we have to constrain it that much, but conceptually it's easy to think about as just being related to the goodwill. Was paid.
Thank you, Zach. Nick?
So similarly, in terms of stewardship, which Bruce particularly commented on, and the issues around commercial sensitivity, I mean, some M&A creates value for shareholders, some destroys value for shareholders. My biggest risk, in my experience, as an existing shareholder, is that the price paid is wrong. And so I'm looking there, and I do a lot of work going backwards, trying to analyse the prices that have been paid. Have they been right in the past? Does this give me some information at the history? But that's my biggest vulnerability. And I tie that together with things that we've heard from some companies that express the view that the proposed disclosures would encourage management to be more considered in the price paid for an acquisition. And that all ties together. That gives me protection. It gives me comfort that there's some checks and balances here around the information provided and how I'm going to fare as an existing shareholder. So very much not a new shareholder, but an existing shareholder. That for me, that's how I think of the stewardship aspect.
Okay. Now, this has been a very interesting discussion. I was thinking, should I come in, should I not come in? I think what this discussion has shown me is that is very important that we flesh out our line of argument and the justification that we bring about why we believe the information is not considered forward-looking and what our reading of paragraph 3.6 in the conceptual framework is. I think that's really important because if people disagree with ours, they should at least see what our rationale is. Whether or not we are deviating from that later on for practical reasons is a separate concern, but I think we need to flesh that out quite clearly. I would also remind us of something that Tadeo has said, which I agree with, is that we are in a world that is changing, and that entire boundary question of are we confining ourselves to the financial statements or do we include something that starts off from the balance sheet or reporting date and goes into forward-looking territory, management commentary, sustainability reporting, whatever it might be, I think is changing, right? And it's not to say that we should be overruling our conceptual framework, but I think we should be mindful that the landscape is changing and also the rigor to the other end of reporting is changing going forward. So that is probably something that we have to keep in mind in order to say, are we concerned about putting this into the financial statements? Is this just a question of should it be reported here or should it be reported there or should it not be reported at all? I think that's then is the question. And I think the more we go into that future direction, it probably becomes more a question of should it be better placed here or there rather than not at all, right? So I think all the arguments have been heard. What I've also heard is that there was a general consensus around the board table that we agree with the staff recommendation. But that is a general agreement. It's not to say we agree with, let's go for it, right? Because there are other factors around that. So can I see a show of hands who agrees with the staff recommendation as drafted?
Nine.
Okay. All right. Then let's continue with 18B.
Thank you, Andreas. So agenda paper 18B focuses on some of the practical concerns, and in particular concerns that some entities might be required to disclose what some might consider to be forward-looking, applying some jurisdiction-specific requirements. In July, the board discussed four practical concerns about the board's preliminary views. And subsequent to that meeting, we did some further outreach, particularly on forward-looking information. And paragraphs 14 and 15 includes some additional information. We understand that entities may be subject to some additional litigation risk and incur some significant additional costs if they make forward-looking statements in some jurisdictions, particularly in the US context. So paragraphs 20 to 42 list some potential alternatives that the board could consider to mitigate this practical concern. Questions for the board are on page 13 of this paper. This paper does not ask the board for a tentative decision, but instead we would like to know if board members have any questions or comments on the additional outreach and forward-looking information or the alternative approaches. And we would also like to know if there's any additional information board members would like before making a decision on the practical challenges for including this, the information that would be required applying the board's preliminary financial statements.
Thanks, Greg. Floor's open. Mary.
Diving in on this, and I'm sorry, I was just looking back at the paper again, thinking about Bertrand and Bruce's concerns about commercial sensitivity and whether that falls into the practical considerations that should be integrated into a decision-making paper. But stepping back, looking at this paper, I think it would be helpful if you started to look at the two aspects separately, one of which is the disclosure of the synergies expected at the date of acquisition versus the subsequent actual performance against the initial expectation, strategic rationale, etc. I think they have very differing, my gut, but I'm not a securities lawyer, most definitely, is that they have very different risks of being considered by courts to be forward-looking information, and so we might end up, you know, we might end up wanting to make different decisions about the costs, benefits, risks, etc., associated with disclosure requirements for each of those, even if our logic chain, is the same for both of them. So separating them is one, and I, you know, frankly, I really, really struggle with understanding how subsequent reporting of actual performance is something that could ever be labeled as forward-looking. If all we are requiring is what has happened already versus, you know, what would happen in the future. And then one other thing that I wanted to highlight, and it's a comment that the staff makes, and I'm struggling to find the paragraph, is that I think paragraph 41, entities often disclose information outside the financial statements that provide quantitative information about the objectives, but rarely disclose information regarding those achievements of the objectives in subsequent periods. Again, this is another reason why I think it's important to separate our consideration of the two aspects, because what paragraph 41 tells me is, in terms of the risk reward, that there's less potentially reward associated with a requirement to disclose quantification of expected synergies in day one, if their market regulation, market pressure, etc., requirements to disclose that as part of the offering document, particularly if you need shareholder approval or you're planning to use shares to pay for the transaction and therefore have to do a securities offering. I think I defer to two user members here, but to me, the biggest information need, the biggest gap that we're trying to fill is the second half of that sentence, rarely disclose information regarding the achievement of those objectives in subsequent period. And that's what the subsequent reporting is about. So of all these things, that's the objective that I give the highest value to. So when we're thinking about practical considerations, that's just a personal view about which one I'd most like to solve.
Hi. Jawed, you had your name taken?
Yeah, I was just going to comment on one thing. So Mary, when you talked about why people think the information about subsequent performance is forward-looking, it's not the reporting in the subsequent periods itself, but it's more the disclosure in the first year that sets up that subsequent reporting. So it's information about the objective and the metrics that are going to be used to measure that. That's the piece that's considered forward-looking. Just if that helps.
Okay. Yeah. I do struggle with understanding why saying it's about market share, it's about employees, it's about IP, it's, qualitative, not non-financial, qualitative information about the rationale and an indication of how you're planning to measure it, whether it's market surveys, internal data, just a description of what it is rather than the number in the year of acquisition would fall into the bucket of forward-looking.
Thank you. Let's hear from Anne.
Thanks, Andreas. Thanks so much for both these papers. And it's great to have all these alternatives to consider. And so as I looked at them and considered them, I would like to comment on a few. I feel that these are responses, alternatives that you'd like us to think about and talk about, a response to the practical concerns. All of them, or certainly most of them, are about would result in less information. We've had discussed many times how important board members think this information is, the investor need for this information we're discussing. And many of these alternatives are talking about providing less of the information. But if I just comment on a couple briefly that I wouldn't consider further, I think the idea of using the management commentary, it isn't a viable option for us to achieve the objectives that we have. And I think about why people tell us to use management commentary, and there's a couple of reasons. One might be that they truly believe that the type of information belongs there. Another might be that they absolutely know it's not our domain, and so we will not be getting this information from a lot of entities if we went down that route. So that one's out for me. So 18B is out. 18E is also out for me because pursuing the work for the disclosure objectives using the in the Principles of Disclosure Project, that's early work and it's not tested yet. It's untried, so that has to go. Now, if I look at the other three, then I thought with 18C and 18D, either of those are a compromise and they would result in less disclosure. And I'm looking forward to hearing what my fellow board members have to say about that, because in both those instances where we say don't require a quantitative disclosure for 18C or for 18D, where we say exempt some entities from providing the disclosure, I think both of those are a way of significantly reducing the information that will be provided and therefore not meeting investor needs in this area. The one that I wanted to ask staff to consider again, rather than dismissing, was the cross-referencing. So in the text of the paper, cross-referencing gets dismissed quite early on. The comment is in the paper is that the cross-referencing wouldn't address the concerns in paragraphs 11 to 16 and the detailed reasons why. And I did look back at July of 2021, 18A, and in there the staff have said that cross-referencing is mainly about duplication of information. It's not really addressing our other issues. I'd like to know more about what we can solve with cross-referencing, because I don't think we can afford to dismiss cross-referencing. We use it in other areas. We've talked about how we use it in IFRS 7. It's a requirement of an accounting standard to provide disclosure, but that can exist outside. So I would like to know more about how that interacts with Safe Harbour. I just think is there more potential in cross-referencing that we're not realising? Earlier today, people have talked about quantitative and non-quantitative information and financial and non-financial and how there's a blurring of boundaries. And I think we're going to be called on more and more in the future to think about cross-referencing. I don't think we're going to have the silos in the future that we've had in the past. And cross-referencing is one way that people have talked about trying to cross the barrier between areas of information. So I would like to ask staff to think some more about that one. Is there something in that alternative that could help us here? Because I see that two of the other alternatives are quite limiting, and then two of the other alternatives I don't think are pursuable. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And Neely, I saw you put your name tag up. What was that on Safe Harbour?
It was on a couple of Anne's points, including Safe Harbour. If
you want to come in now.
So thank you for that, Anne. And maybe just to answer the point about 18A and cross-referencing, the challenge is that in the U.S., even if you cross-reference to information located somewhere else, that cross-reference pulls the information into the financial statements. So you're back, there's no difference between cross-referencing or having that information in the financial statements. So the practical concern about Safe Harbour is still the same, which is why I think we sort of put 18A to the side pretty quickly. To the other points, and the team can jump in if I misspeak, but with respect to 18D and that reducing information, part of the thinking is that the information could be provided elsewhere. So it's still provided to investors, but perhaps it's not audited. However, it just wouldn't be in the financial statement. So it's still trying to convey the same types of information, but just in a different location without the risk of Safe Harbour. And then with respect to 18E and the disclosure pilot project, part of the thinking there is providing objectives, but then having the preparer have alternatives for how those objectives would be met. So I take your point that it's still early days for that project, but the idea here is there might be different ways that we can satisfy the objective, and instead of mandating it needs to be this way, a preparer could have different options to meet that objective.
Thank you, Neely. Tadeo.
Thank you, Andreas. First, again, very nice, good paper, good reading. I like the alternative of the objective-based approach in paragraph 38. I know that this is still early stages, but we already use objective-based approach in the standards today. It's just a stronger approach that we are trying this pilot approach that we are trying today. But if we combine that one with the alternative, for example, that you have in 18D, that's about exempt entities from disclosing particular information, financial statements in some circumstance, and then therefore you have the objective-based approach, and then you have this analysis of the circumstance, the safe harbor and other concerns, depending on the legislation. Maybe a combination between these two should be a good solution, of course, subject to some refinement. Talking to regulators for this subject, I think that it is indeed recommended and necessary for us to move forward. And I have one additional point on paragraph 7, it said that respondents particularly highlighted potential difficulties in auditing non-financial or non-GAAP information. It is in 7B. I think that's important to mention that these observations were not made by audit firms, as in the papers in the past, it was clear that most accounting firms, auditing bodies did not comment on the auditability of this information. I think that it came probably from other stakeholders. I acknowledge that there will be the cost for preparing the information to make it auditable and also need to work closely with, for example, the IWSCB to ensure the information is auditable within the user's expectation. But I have problem in accepting the view that moving the information to management commentary to avoid auditability makes sense. I mean, that it shouldn't be the case. I'm sure users would appreciate this information to be audited, of course, subject to addressing some practical concerns. And we should primarily conclude whether this information belongs to the financial statement, then discuss questions such as cost of preparation, auditability, and other practical concerns. Thank you, Andreas.
Thank you, Tadeo. Bruce.
Thanks very much. So, yeah, thanks to the staff for the alternatives. I mean, I think it's kind of difficult to read 18A and 18B separately because I think this is starting to get into the challenges we had in terms of those. I mean, if I just take a look at the alternatives that have been put out there, I mean, to start off with, and maybe just to make it clear, I'm not opposed to saying that the information that we're proposing giving isn't valuable. I mean, I think there's a lot of value to that. My concern, of course, is the issue around whether we're requiring people to give it in all circumstances. And I think if we start going through those alternatives, I like the fact that we're starting to address that we do almost accept that this isn't something we're going to say you have to comply full stop with. If we just go through them, I mean, I think for the comments made by others, A and B to me aren't really starters. I mean, the cross-referencing, as Nelly says, is just going to pull it straight back in. The practice statement isn't used by everybody, so I'm not convinced even if we replace that with management reporting. I think this does need the rigor of being in the financial statements, and I would support if we're going to put it in there, we put it in there. The ones that I start looking at, if I start looking at kind of C and D, I mean, the idea in C to me it's a mix, and I think that's what I'd look at is kind of a mix between C and D, because I see the two of them kind of lie into each other. So to me, if I looked at D and I like the idea of the comply or explain, I mean, so saying, look, if you're not going to comply with this and you feel there's good reasons to give it, to me, that's when the alternative we're going to see could come in and be a good kind of, well, therefore, we at least want you to try and give some of this degree. So I kind of saw the two as following on from each other in a reverse order, because I think that I like the idea of saying to people, look, if we're going to put these requirements in, they're there, but we do understand that there are circumstances in which you can't do that. And that's where I like the idea of saying, well, that, as we said, that comply, explain. To me, the explain was really what we'd put into C. Rather say to people, well, what can you give? Are there objectives? Are there things you can give that are not going to breach that commercial sensitivity area, that aren't going to be out of touch, that's going to impact on the company? So I think I would look at whether it's, to me, a bit of a hybrid between the two. On the one on E, on the objective-based approach, I mean, I like the idea of an objective-based approach, but I mean, I do share the concerns that we're still out there. The jury's out in terms of whether we're going to take that approach, and I guess it would be difficult, I think, for us to pursue that at the moment on the basis that we're still waiting for feedback on the TSLR project, and I think it would be difficult to say, well, we're going to do that, and then if that project gets canned because the overwhelming response from people is don't go that way, then we've kind of wasted time on that. But I mean, I do think that even if we didn't go all the way there, I do like the idea of having some objectives around it. And I think given that this is a bit more sensitive disclosure, this isn't all give the opening balance for assets. This is a bit more around management and what they're giving. So if we are going to go down that route, I do think we should try and beef up on the objectives a bit more. So management understand what the objective is of what they're trying to put in. So kind of the thing I'm saying is I don't think it's a one or the other. To me, I would look at C, D, and E and say, is there a way to craft that into something that if we're going to start with that hierarchy, if you're not going to comply because you think you can't, explain what it is. We give the quantitative disclosures where we can. But I think overall there should be an objective that people can apply in deciding what to put in what out. So, yeah, I know it's a strange answer, but I think to me it's a hybrid of those three if we're going to go anywhere on that. Thank you.
Tom.
So I liked this paper.
I like the options that you guys presented because I think there's some really good thought about achieving what are really desirable disclosures, which is still my where I would like to end up is getting the really desirable disclosures out there. First note that none of these are mutually exclusive. So, you know, we might still, even if not a lot of people use our practice statement, one of our arguments about the practice statement on management commentary is that it does influence other people who write their own MD&A or whatever. So we could still have that influence path work. So I would think about that. I think about some of the others. I think on the objective-based approach, I take the point that the specific proposal we have out may not be accepted in the specific form it is. I think it will survive in some form. And I think this is a really good idea in this case is however that ends up, is some variant on it or exactly what it has. I think, and let me say why I think this is a good way to go. First of all, I want to just invoke commercial sensitivity here for a moment. One of the reasons I don't get quite as excited or upset as my conceptual self gets very upset about anything to do with the conceptual framework just by nature. My mind finds them fascinating. But the forward-looking, I think most forward-looking information is probably, if I did a Venn diagram, is probably subsumed in the commercial sensitivity circle. There's probably not a lot of forward-looking that's actually outside the commercial sensitivity circle. And I think, so if I'm being really pragmatic about getting this through, I think commercial sensitivity will be the bigger reef that we could wreck on. And one of the reasons I really like the objective, so that was one thing is, and I'll tie it back in a second. The other one was Mary just said we want to split out things. And I said earlier, it would be really good to think about things that we think are fundamentally not forward-looking, information about the transaction. And those ones are a different defense than ones where it starts to tread into this forward-looking. So if we split out and did the obvious ones, and that's where I really like this structure of objectives. So again, if we come with an overall objective, if you recall the structure, and then specific objectives. For example, we might have a specific objective fundamentally asking a question, what did you buy? Okay, and that can be quite fact-based. We bought a thing and it's constituted, this is how we, you know, here's the assets we bought, here's the intangible assets we recognized, here's the goodwill we rest largely on synergies or whatever. I think that can be reasonably factual. We could also have one, though, which people really care about is the subsequent performance of the acquisition, and we had to do a lot of entity-specific to get those things out there. But that could be another specific objectives. And by splitting them, it then lets us bring in these specific items under each one. And I'd remind us that even though we downplayed the mandatory ones, the way that thing had it was you then put specific items under each specific objective. And if it was really important, we could make them mandatory. So again, in this case, we could kind of put a second dimension on making mandatory. Where we think we're going to really violate commercial sensitivities, we'd be less likely to make it mandatory. Where we thought that it clearly wasn't forward-looking, it clearly wasn't commercially sensitive and really valuable, we could simply say, you know, make it mandatory. And so I think we could build something that works really well off that, and it would give the entities that are really worried about commercial sensitivity. I like it because they've got the specific objective. They have to do their best to satisfy it. If they invoke commercial sensitivity, they won't use specific items that we might recommend, but they have an onus to try and do something else. And I just think that this path is really worth exploring. And even if the disclosure thing doesn't survive in exactly the same form, I think it really lends itself to the characteristics of this set of problems that we face in getting these disclosures out. So I would encourage you to explore it in some form. And thinking about that structure and thinking about what can be mandatory and why, and then what you might want to make non-mandatory. And it just kind of skates around that whole debate to some degree is giving management the onus to do, tell us what you reasonably can to satisfy the specific objective, and we're going to give you a break on the commercially sensitive.
Thanks, Tom. Sue.
Well, so firstly, thank you for a very thorough paper, but I have to say I found it profoundly depressing. A few observations and one question. I think one was answered by Neely. But my question was, you know, I'd been hoping that we'd be able to ask for information about, you know, what you've achieved versus what you had hoped, if you like. And so when I look at how much we think we can require of that and these restrictions brought in by the forward-looking issues, it's hard to achieve that because I feel a little bit underwhelmed at the idea of being told that the actual revenue has increased by 98 million. And by the way, it didn't meet my target, if I don't know whether I've missed by 2 million or 200 million. You know, so, you know, how upset or otherwise should I be? Could they not, in the year when they achieve the 98 million, at that point say, you know, and the auditors could check, they could write it down in the background in their papers that nobody sees, our target actually had been 100 million for this period. Could they not say it in the period? Not in advance, but on the day, because they say, okay, we achieved 98 million, and by the way, we tell you now, we had written down that our objective was 100 million or 500 million. Could they do it then?
I think it might depend on whether that objective spans several years. And so if their ultimate objective was to increase revenue in a five-year period, you might not be able to do it after 1 year or 2 years or so on.
Because otherwise, I think, you know, it doesn't feel terribly useful to me. And if that's the best we can do, then I'm profoundly depressed. But then looking at paragraph 18 and reacting to some of these ideas, for me, you know, I get up in the morning and my objective is to make sure IFRS financial statements are really as good as we can make them. So saying, let's put something in management commentary is, if I have to do that and that's the best I can do, that's okay. But I'd much rather we try and do the best we can in the financial statements in the first instance. So I wouldn't lean on that too heavily until that becomes the last thing that we've got to work with personally, just given the way that our literature works. And then if I look at some of the ideas, just to flag a couple of, you know, thoughts as I was looking at it. On the idea of comply or explain and this idea that basically you would be required to provide, you know, as much quantitative information as we can get unless you've disclosed it elsewhere or you can't because of litigation risk. And this isn't commercial sensitivity. It's written as litigation risk, even though some have said commercial sensitivity. The thing that troubles me with that, even though that would be helpful and that it would mean that we'd get the maximum possible information provided because that would be the only reason you would not provide it, is I think we're very soon going to have very difficult conversations with people because if you happen to have operations in a jurisdiction with very strict litigation risk and regulation, you're going to be able to say, sorry, I can't give you that information. And I'm not going to give it anywhere else either. I can just say, sorry, litigation risk, not giving that. And then another entity who also applies our requirements is going to be required by us to provide it. And they're going to say, that's not very fair. This is commercially sensitive. Why doesn't he have to do it and I have to do it? And the whole level playing field argument, I think, will be very difficult for us, even though it's great that we've got the best information. I don't know how, as an ISB board member, I have a conversation with the person who has to provide the disclosures who feels disadvantaged with, you know, his peer not getting out of it. And it's already hard enough when something's required or not by us or the FASB to have these level playing field arguments, but we'd actually be bringing our own level playing field issues into our literature. And personally, I think that would be a really difficult conversation to have with preparers, and I'd feel quite uncomfortable about it. An objective-based approach is sort of nice in the sense that it's a way of sort of encouraging people to do the best they can, taking into account all of these, you know, situations that they're trying to deal with. But I don't feel strongly comforted by it for two reasons. One is that, as people know because of my dissent, I'm worried about the flexibility and how that might be used by preparers in a not great way in some circumstances, and we know preparers are not that keen on this disclosure. So the more woolly it is, the worse the possible outcome might be. But more fundamentally, my concern is that if our basic issue is some of the quantitative information we really would have liked to have been provided to be really useful to users just really can't be achieved for, you know, legitimate regulatory and litigation reasons, no matter how I draft it, if I write it as an objective, whether I write it as a requirement, whether I write it as comply or explain, I'm still not going to get the information that I wanted to be provided. So I'm not sure how an objective-based articulation makes me feel much better, because the output is still going to be not what I'd hoped to achieve because of all of these legitimate things people are grappling with. So for me, objective-based approaches are good in the sense that they can provide a framework, they make people think about good communication, they make people think about what would be good information. But if the background is they actually can't provide the information that would be the really useful information, drafting it as an objective-based requirement doesn't help me solve my basic issue. So for me, it doesn't give me much comfort. Sorry. I don't know then where that leaves me or you.
All depressed. In a very depressed way.
Thank you. I think, first of all, overall, there are no one-size-fits-all solutions to address all of information. So we need to consider the multiple options or multiple things to address or issues or practical. And then also, I think so where I start? I also think I believe that, yes, there are serious issues about commercial sensitivities and litigations. It depends on the environment and which businesses the company engages in. So I really think, at the same time, management always have a good excuse not to disclose the important information that can be disclosed in the financial statement. So I understand Sue's concern about the disclosure approach, especially about the objective-based disclosure. So we really need to have a realistic solution to address all individual issues properly in the different situation or different environment. So considering that, I really think we still need to explore a close reference, because even though it might be a good solution if we consider the U.S. legal environment, but some other entity and in different jurisdictions feel more comfortable to disclose what we required in new standards or amendment to the standards. So I think, and also the cross-reference can reduce repetition and also provide good information in the same place where that management explained the similar information together. So I think it might be more useful for user to read the information in the same place. So that's one thing. And another thing about, I actually like the idea itself is a good about the disclosure objective-based approach, but I still have a concern about that flexibility might be too much. So before considering addressing the issue by identify the high level and specific objective of disclosure, I'm wondering if staff can consider whether we can provide some specific disclosure items about metrics, because I might think the management can provide a type of metrics like revenue or growth gross profit or something. And then also the unit to measure the metrics, probably a segment or a group of business or subsidiary A or C. And also the frequency of measurement, like a quarterly or annually or semi-annually. And how the management, how the metrics relate to the strategic objectives. If those kind of the information are qualitatively described in the first year of the acquisition, at minimum, the investor understand what type of the metrics management is going to look at in the subsequent years. And then if the subsequent performance is explained in the next year and then following years, and then they can check, management can more comfortable to explain how they continue monitoring those measures going forward. So I think I just wondering if we can pursue, we can specify some type of the items to be disclosed in the first year that entity acquired new businesses.
Thank you, Rika. Nick. Thanks. So just a few observations, I guess. So just building on Rika's point, I don't rule out an objectives-based approach. I think there are already some elements of that in what we have. I think what we do have on the table today, which we've had some mixed feedback on, is using the information that's provided to the chief operating decision maker. And I wonder if that's put some fear in. I also recall a CMAC UPF meeting a couple of years ago where we had some very detailed illustrations of what we thought the information might look like. So I think we need to think about that and whether there are opportunities to dispel some of that fear. I guess where I started was about having prescribed pieces of information, but I think we could illustrate there are different types of information that could be provided to fulfill what we're trying to get to. I could have information on what the sales growth was. That could be very helpful. Equally, you could just tell me what the operating profit had been delivered. The various ways of doing this. And I think that's what we were trying to do, empower companies to tell us what would be the best metric to do that. Now, so I think that's still important. You talk about paragraph 9 potentially developing illustrative examples to help us with that. I think it's worth exploring. I think also we need to be careful on that all of a sudden we don't box ourselves into a position by putting an illustrative example out there. The last thing I'll do, and I don't dispute at all what Nili has told us about cross-referencing, he's absolutely right of it. That is the case, but the world is changing. And there is a strong desire. The word that we hear all the time is connectivity, and we hear that from across stakeholders, including some in France, and wanting to link, and we hear it from regulators and auditors as well. And so they can't both, prohibit cross-referencing for time immemorial and seek to have more connectivity. So something we'll have to give at some stage, and we just need to be cognizant of that, I think.
I think that might be a good time that I come in just clarify my position, because when I heard some of you saying cross-referencing and management commentary is out of the window, I would say these would be my preferred options, actually. And that's for a reason that has to do probably with the jurisdictional background that we are in. So in Germany, management commentary gets audited with the same degree of assurance as the financial statements. There's no difference at all. So the issue is less about does the degree of assurance or attestation change? It's more about the duplication issue, right? And here, it is about management commentary is already taking management's position as to how it develops the strategy, how it goes about acquisitions, how it monitors the success of that. So that's why people, specifically from my jurisdiction, have said we believe that much of this talk, this information, is better housed in management commentary than it is in the financial statements. It's not to say this should never go into the financial statements, because they clearly realize that if you do have a goodwill number, surely you want to have some information that's related to that. But the question was, can you not provide that through cross-referencing into the management commentary? And I think, to draw on Nick's last point, I think we need to be very careful going forward that we don't try to really put a divider here and saying this is ours, this is financial statements, and this is theirs, this is management commentary, but rather think about holistic corporate reporting that is interconnected. And I think once we get there, I think the question about cross-referencing comes up automatically, I think. And this is just as an explanation as to why people that have commented from my jurisdiction have made these comments. So all the concerns that are in there in terms of, is this forward-looking, is there a lower level of attestation, don't apply in my country. It's really about duplication and unnecessary duplication. And the question about if we do have a document where management gives its view about the strategy and the performance, is that not a better place to house this information? That's just to give some feedback to that. Jinjiao, Bertrand, Mary.
Can I just react to
yes,
that?
Yes, please,
though,
sure.
Because I want to make sure we're not talking across the...
Sure.
I'd be totally fine with having a square brackets requirement to provide particular information about a business combination, us requiring it, mm-hmm. somebody deciding to locate it in the management yes. commentary and have a cross-reference.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But my only point is I'd like us to require it. Mm-hmm. The question of location then to me is secondary. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying not in management commentary for a location reason.
Yep.
Rather, I don't want to not have a requirement in our standards and instead say, by the way, in management commentary document,
yep.
put it over, you know, specify it over there. So I'm fine with the cross-referencing. Mm-hmm. So just to be clear,
okay.
it's not a location point for
yep.
me. It's a, is it a requirement of IFRS yep. financial requirements? And also, I don't think the cross-referencing helps us with the safe harbour issue.
No, that's right. That's the litigation thing.
So,
that's right.
So that's my only reaction to cross-referencing. Yeah. I'm all for efficiency of cross-referencing yeah. and avoiding duplication, just to be clear.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. I have Jinjiao, Bertrand, Mary and Zach.
Yes, thanks. And yes, thank you very much for your comments on the management commentary, because initially I rule out all the, you know, option which will be included in the management commentary, because as Sus mentioned, that first option we need to choose is that should be a requirement. So if for some jurisdiction, management commentary are not mandatory, not a requirement, I think they need to be included in the financial statement, because there are no other way the users can get those information. So this is, I think, first position. Secondly, how can we approach this, those information need to be required to be disclosed? I also, as Nick said, that I also think that we should not rule out objective-based approach. Not only rule out objective-based approach, I think we needed to start from objective-based approach. I totally agree with what Tadu said, that even we are now, the disclosure initiative has not yet finalized, the new consultative feedback from stakeholders, but if we look at the recent IFRS standard we issued, actually, we tried to build on the objective-based approach to develop our disclosure requirements. So I think we should not wait until disclosure initiative completed. I think we still can identify those, as Tom said, overall objective, specific objective, and maybe specific disclosure requirement. We needed to develop those information. I think we have got a lot of information already. So I think we can do it, start from that. Secondly, I do have sympathy with approach D, because maybe some companies, I think Bruce also mentioned before, disclose some information may create some significant litigation risk for them. So whether we can do something building on the objective-based approach, but to provide some, you know, very narrow exemption for those companies to, you know, to choose what kind of information really sensitive enough, and do not force them to disclose all the information, which will damage their reputation, their operation, and their development. So but how narrowly those scope will be, I'm not sure. So I would like the staff to do a little bit further outreach to check, as Sue mentioned, what kind of legal system, regulatory system in place in some jurisdictions. Even those jurisdictions have this kind of legal system in place, how many cases arising, litigation risk arising from those business combination, transactions, disclosures. If it's really rare, and I think we do not need to worry about too much. If there are some cases, let's look at those cases, what kind of risk, what kind of litigation risk will arise. And then it will help us to develop our very narrow scope exemption. But overall, I think we should build our disclosure requirements based on clear objective, particularly in this regard, because we are developing new, fresh disclosure requirements in relation to the business combination. It's very different from other disclosure requirements. So clear objective, I think, is the key. Thank you.
Thanks. And Joao, Petron.
I think the staff lacked good directions on the project with the five directions that they could take. I think it's a useful paper in this regard. Thanks for that. The only comment I had then was address the issue of commercial sensitivity, so I won't repeat myself. But having heard others, a couple of additional comments maybe. First thing, I'm on the same page as Bruce, Nick, or Qinqiao on the objective-based approach. And of course, I'm quite aligned with Bruce on, it won't be a surprise for you, it's why I'm saying.
Next time we separate you.
considering E, C, and D all together, of course. And I think it will be a challenge. But when I hear Nick presenting a user's perspective, with such an approach, there may be a possibility to try to find a consensus. Otherwise, I fear it will be difficult to reach a consensus. The second comment I would make is in relation to what Anne-Rika and Nick and eventually Sue said on cross-referencing and what you said, Andreas, on cross-referencing. It's something from the jurisdiction I come from, it's impossible. The auditors have always refused any cross-reference from the MD&A report to the financial statements. So I can't imagine from the management commentary to the financial statements. And the reason is because it's for pure legal responsibility, their legal responsibility, of course, which is civil, a professional, and a criminal responsibility. And this has been the case since 1966, so it's not something very new. And the main reason is the auditor's report in France is flagged in three parts. And the first part is the certification of accounts and of financial statements, or eventually the non-certification, of course. And then there's portions relating to the two other sections are other reviews. And notably, one of them is, of course, the financial information contained in the MD&A report, and it's not the same level of legal responsibility they are taking. So it's something very similar to what Neely flagged, as is the case probably in the US, even though I'm not very familiar with the legal procedures in the US. But from what I've heard, she explains, we are in a very similar place in France. And I'm pretty sure that if we were to look on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis, I'm pretty sure that we would find other jurisdictions that are very similar to that. So that's where I'm uncomfortable with cross-referencing, because on a mere legal standpoint, I know that it's not working. And then the last comment I would like to make, why I'm so concerned on commercial sensitivity is because of the legal consequences for the preparers, for the companies, and the legal responsibilities of the companies and their management. And so the cost for the companies would be the consequences of legal actions against the companies and their management. That is where if you think of a cost-benefit approach, the costs are really the potential consequences in terms of legal implications for the companies and their management. And it's not a theoretical issue. It's a very practical issue and a very, very significant one.
Thanks, Baton. Mary, please.
Just really coming back on two points. One is I want to emphasize something that Tom pointed out, is that commercial sensitivity and forward-looking are not interchangeable terms, that there may be a big overlap, you know, if you think about a Venn diagram in terms of those two populations, but they're very different attributes. So I think it's important that when you're doing analysis, you distinguish which issue you are addressing. And the other thing I'll say about commercial sensitivity, I think we should be regarding it, considering it as a cost, but not a barrier. You know, so the fact that something is commercially sensitive does not preclude us from requiring it. I think we just have to consider it to have perhaps a higher cost associated with disclosing it than we would if it was something that was not commercially sensitive. So it's to say, I think we need to think about it in terms of a cost. And then the other thing, and I want to be clear that I'm not calling to go down this route. In paragraph 18, D, and when you build that out later, you talk about saying, I think in paragraph 33B, that you'd be exempt if providing the information in the financial statements could result in significant additional litigation risk. If you are analyzing that possible route further, I'd like you to consider having the hurdle be the entity concluding that it would create significant additional litigation risk, because I think it's a pretty low hurdle to say, oh, there could be more risk associated with this, and it's a pretty blanket statement. I think I might, I would want to think differently about saying, if you've done your analysis and have a basis for determining that there would be, that there, it doesn't have to be absolute, but that you have concluded that there would be significant additional litigation risk. So that's why I'm commenting about changing one letter, but why I thought it was worth coming back in to do that.
Okay. So we have about 6 minutes left. Can I ask the remaining speakers to be brief on their points of Zach, Tadeo, and Tom?
Thanks. So first, really appreciate the thought and creativity that went into this paper. We've got a practical challenge, and we're trying to resolve a practical challenge. And to borrow Tom's metaphor, simile, I understood this paper is focused just on litigation risk. So there are lots of reefs we can wreck on, but here we're talking about litigation risk and litigation risk only. So that's the context I took in it. In terms of the options and what we could do, I came to the conclusion that management commentary was out too, actually for some of the same reasons that Andreas thought it should be included, which is just a different way of thinking. And as I looked at it and the other options, part of the difficulty to me is the subjectivity of the assessment on litigation risk. And for that reason, I actually wouldn't apply the objectives-based approach, because all these decisions and conclusions occur within a political system where different actors get to play a role. And when all the pressures push you towards non-disclosure, it's probably not the best time to apply a subjective objective in where you want to go. So for that reason, I crossed that off too. I think what Mary said earlier is really important as I'm thinking about some of the other options, though, is we really should be thinking of this on a two-track basis. One is the initial disclosures where we see more litigation risk, and the subsequent disclosures where we really don't see any. So there may actually be an element of combining the third and fourth option of saying we wouldn't require the initial disclosures, or maybe we could allow you to use initial disclosures that are located everywhere. Because as a user who is based in the most litigious area of the world, as Thomas quoted again, I can tell you, you see these frequently as initial disclosures outside the financial statements. So I have less concerns about saying, look, we just want you to disclose it. I don't care where, but the subsequent stuff, that you have to disclose, because that's the gap in information that we're trying to solve. You can't do the second without the first, but as long as you disclose it, we're comfortable with that. So I'm actually a little bit more comfortable with pursuing that one. Not to wordsmith too much, but in that option, though, there was one word that I did object to, which is we presented two criteria for what would allow you to be exempt, and we said or between the two. To me, that's an and. You are exempt if you first already disclose this information, and to follow Mary's suggestion, including it in the financial statements would create litigation risk, which is a very different proposition than if one of these two is true, then you don't have to disclose.
Thanks, Zach. Today.
Thank you, Andreas. It's just to pass an information about the national standards on auditing. When you have a cross-reference in the financial statements to an information outside the financial statement, it is the same as if the information was in the financial statements. It needs to be audited. It will not make the audit easier. I mean, it is almost the same as if the information was in the financial statements. Just this comment. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tadeo. Tom, you had your big up. Okay. You're done. All right. Okay, then I think this was a very fruitful, although depressing discussion, to use Sue's comments. But I want to circle it back and see whether you have enough food for thought, or whether there is anything that we else can do in order to screw this up even further.
No, I think we...
Okay. Then thank you very much, and also my thanks go to De Hao, who couldn't be with us today. We all wish him well, but I think the team did a great job in presenting the paper, so thank you very much. We close this item and go for a 15-minute break and reconvene at 11:30.